Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight, Tuesday, the 8th of May. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. Today is Victory in Europe Day. Tomorrow will also be Victory in Europe Day. But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our tasks, both at home and abroad. Advance, Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!
Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulos.
So, yeah, I know, it's been forever since I put up a podcast. I think the last time something went up was like the Christmas special of 2019, which actually went up in sometime in January, and honestly, I really don't have any excuse. Okay, well, I did get sick for the whole month of February. I had the flu and then pneumonia, although it's a little strange because I got tested twice for the flu and it wasn't the flu, so maybe it could have been COVID, but February for COVID in Mexico, I think it's a little early. Either way, so then all of February was lost. Man, I really felt like shit. And a lot of the symptoms, by the way, of COVID. But again, I mean, it's just too early to have been COVID. And then COVID came and whatever and so forth. But anyway, so this is the fourth episode of myth busting that the Nazis were these great military strategists. Yeah, right. I mean, I had to cut it down to four episodes. I could have went on for like 20 of them, but and it's the final in the series. And you know, like I said, in spite of the fact that these things have been a little sporadic lately. Actually, they've been sporadic since the beginning of the podcast, to be honest with you. But a little bit more sporadic than regular. I do have a couple of interviews lined up. One on the future of North America, and another one on NATO and its new mission, I guess. The new mission being looking back to the way things were in the 60s, 70s, and especially the 80s with the Russians. So those will be coming out, like, I suspect within the next month. You know, for those who have missed the podcast, there's three of them going to be coming out in a relatively short period of time. I suspect approximately within about a month. So without further ado, let's go to episode 4 of myth busting that the Nazis were these great military strategists, which is just bonkers. So on to the fourth and last episode of the Nazis being these great military strategists. Ha ha ha. Enjoy, and I'll see you soon. I think. Okay, so the last time we were talking about Hitler as a awesome, great military strategist was right around the successful German Nazi military campaign in Stalingrad, where the Germans were successful in surrendering en masse to the Russians. And I'm going to fast forward, but the next big thing that I guess that's worth mentioning as far as you know, great German military strategy is concerned, is the famous or infamous Battle of the Kursk. Now, the Battle of the Kursk was Russians essentially decimated the Germans at the Battle of the Kursk. Well, they decimated themselves in the process, but, you know, the way Stalin was, he didn't give a shit about whether or not he's gonna lose people or tanks or stuff like that. I mean, it was a numbers game, most definitely at that point in time, especially because now the Nazis need to start facing the fact that the Allies have landed in Italy, and you can't throw as many troops to the Eastern Front as you want to, or as you had hoped for, given the fact that, the Allies have chosen to invade in what they refer to as the soft underbelly of Europe. But preceding the Battle of Kursk, which took place in 1943, it was a pretty long campaign. The Battle of the Kursk was the result of a German offensive, came to be actually known as the last German offensive, Operation Citadel. So the Battle of the Kursk, which took place in July, August of 1943, was preceded, like I just mentioned, by Operation Citadel, which was yet another German attempt at a offensive, because they've been so damn good at these offensives lately that they figured that they should, you know, continue on these offensives. Well, not the Germans, I mean, you know, Hitler. So, strategically speaking, the Russians had figured out that it was actually a better idea to just assume a defensive position and just wait for the Germans to attack, because then you just knew that the Germans just couldn't control themselves. They just had to attack. Or not the Germans, again, the Nazi leadership kept on insisting that you must attack. Operation Citadel, which was this German attack, took place along the Russian-German front, about 400 kilometers, 450 kilometers from in front of Moscow, more or less. So at this point, you know, the Germans have made some significant mistakes that I haven't been discussing, and have been pushed back. Some significant mistakes after Stalingrad as well, leading to the point where they've been pushed back quite a bit by the Soviets. The German high command, the Wehrmacht, the German army, they wanted to set up something that Field Marshal von Meinstein had referred to as like a mobile defense, where they could essentially move troops around, move troops and materiel and tanks especially, around where it was needed depending on where the Soviets might attack, expecting the Soviets to attack. But Hitler kept on insisting that the German forces must go on the offensive. And Hitler decided that Kursk was a really, really good place to do that. And in April, he authorized an operation that came to be known as Operation Citadel, which is what we're going to talk about right now. What had happened was that a salient had been produced, like I said, about 400 kilometers in front of Moscow. Salient being I really should figure out a way how to bring maps into a podcast. I mean, I could, but I know you're not going to look at them. But imagine a line where you have like this, the front, you have the front, and then there's this part of the front, like I said, about 400 kilometers from Moscow, where you have Soviet forces kind of jutting into German-occupied territory. And the idea is that what the Germans want to do is they want to kind of close off this pocket of, now it's not quite yet a pocket because it's just jutting in, right? What they want to do is turn it into a pocket and then wipe it out. Again, not dissimilar to what happened in Stalingrad to the Germans. And very, very similar, in fact, to the Battle of the Battle of the Ardennes, Western Europe, which is going to take place in the winter of 1944 or 1945. So what Operation Citadel called for was to attack the Russians from, you know, the north part where they're jutting in, and from the south part, and to create this pocket and to seal these Soviet forces off. Again, I must stress that this was something that the German high command, the Wehrmacht, opposed vehemently. The fights at this point are getting very, very serious between the Nazis, Hitler, and so forth, and the German high command. And it is a myth that, you know, you couldn't fight with Hitler because he'd put a bullet in your head. You could fight with Hitler, especially if you were someone like Manstein or some other generals, because some of these people were, number one, they were quite famous, quite popular in Germany, but the other thing is that you need these people, so killing them off is really not going to help your war effort very, very much. In other words, Hitler knows that people like Manstein, who's the one I'm thinking of, Guderian, just finished reading his book, actually, Tank Commander. Hitler needs these people, so you would just have these endless fights where they were screaming at each other. On the one hand, you have the German high command, which is like, you know, do not attack, this is not smart, and Hitler insisting that he has to attack because it's the only way he's going to win the war. Well, they've lost the war already, and the Wehrmacht knows this, and the idea is how to, you know, essentially keep, as far as the Wehrmacht is concerned, is how to essentially minimize losses, keep the Germans, keep the Soviets from occupying more territory and quite possibly reaching German territory, because I kind of think the German high command knows what's going to come if, in terms of revenge, if the Soviets ever actually reach Germany, which of course we know they did. In the end, of course, the generals have to give in and they have to launch this attack that Hitler was so fond of, named Operation Citadel. So, to remember, the Russians have already figured out that we're gonna just sit and wait for the Germans to attack and hold our defensive positions, because that's the best way to do it. And the German Wehrmacht is telling Hitler that we can't attack, we shouldn't attack. They already figured out that the only thing that we do is attack and eventually lose and get our butts kicked. And what does Hitler say? The great strategist? Attack. And one last thing before we actually start talking about Operation Citadel. The Russians actually knew the attack was coming because British intelligence had actually told Stalin and Zhukov and the rest of the Russians that an attack was coming. So they were kind of sitting by waiting for it. Actually, it was in planning in early of 1943, May 1943, leading up to this Operation Citadel, that we probably have one of the most infamous interactions between Hitler and one of his generals, General Guderian. General Guderian was a, let's say, a hero of the Battle of France, hero of the Battle of Poland, very highly regarded tank commander, and he opposed this Operation Citadel from the beginning. He kept on telling Hitler, like, why are we even attacking in the east at all? Why are we even attacking at the Kursk? It really doesn't matter if the Kursk is taken or lost or who the hell owns it. And Hitler responded to Guderian, starting to actually scream at Hitler now, Hitler responded by saying that you're quite right. Whenever I think of this attack, my stomach turns over. Guderian then said, well, I mean, if we're not committed to this, then why go ahead and with it at all. And Hitler responded by saying, and this is what literally led to Guderian flipping, and the word in his own biography is that he turned red in the face and had to be literally dragged out of the room with his meeting from Hitler, because he was gonna like beat the shit out of him probably at that particular moment in time. Not that Guderian wasn't sympathetic, let's say, to some of the goals of the Nazi Party per se, but still, in response to Guderian saying that, like, well, you know, if we're not committed to this damn thing, why are we doing it anyways? And Hitler responded by saying, in 1932 we attained victory only by stubbornness that sometimes looked like madness. So too we will achieve it today. And Guderian, with this, flipped and lost it and had to be dragged out of the room with apparently faces red as a tomato, screaming at Hitler, wanting to beat the crap out of him. Probably should have let him do it, because maybe the war would have ended a little earlier. Either way, as it stands, the attack went forward. The attack was scheduled to go forward in late May. It was postponed because of logistical issues. Then it was set to go forward in June. And I can just picture, you know, the Russians watching the preparations for this and saying, dudes, like, we kind of know what you're up to. Postponement after postponement after postponement of this attack. Of course, the Russians aren't attacking. They're just sitting behind their defensive positions and fortifying those positions even more. Are just sitting there waiting for this German attack to finally take place, which it does. The attack actually begins in early July of 1943. And to make a long story short, you know, there were some initial successes in trying to shut this salient, this pocket, to try to create this pocket from both sides. They attacked from the south and from the north. But of course, it was a question of numbers, and it was also a question of the fact that the Russians had been prepared for this, knew it was coming. And the German army had been, had been going through a process of decimation. Eventually, this assault from the north and the south to try to create this pocket, came to a halt. And the Russians counterattacked, and that's what came to be called the Battle of Kursk. Now, Operation Citadel was actually called off, and the reason it was called off was around that time is when the Allies are landing in Italy, and Hitler decides that he needs some of those units that are fighting in the east to go over and help stop the advance of the Allies as they're moving northward through the Italian soft underbelly. This also kind of links into the previous myth-busting series that I did, which was that the Russians won World War II single-handedly. Well, you know, I mean, Operation Citadel was actually called off because of the landings in Italy, and that was significant contribution to the war effort in the east, something that the Russians refused to acknowledge, and I suspect Putin should know it. Hashtag Putin. Are you listening, buddy? So Citadel was called off, yes, of course, partly because the attack was slowed down, but again, also partly because the Allies, the Western Allies rather, had landed in Italy, and Hitler needed some of these troops that were fighting in the east to get their asses over to Italy as quick as possible to hold off the so-called soft underbelly of Nazi Germany. I'm going to say it again. I know I just said it, but I really, really want to emphasize, hashtag Putin, that the Battle of Kursk, you know, essentially the counteroffensive by the Russians, was made possible, at least in part, by the fact that the Western Allies invaded Italy. So there you go. So much for the Soviet Union single-handedly winning the Second World War.
So just to get back to the Battle of Kursk, that was, I guess, could be referred to as the Russian counteroffensive against the German Operation Citadel, which had failed for the reasons we just discussed. And it was an incredible success for the Soviets. It was a significant strategic victory for them, even given the fact that they lost significantly more men and material than the Germans did, simply because by this point the Germans are really running down on supplies. I mean, the German tanks were superior, but fewer in number. The Soviet tanks were quantitatively greater in number. They took significantly more hits. I'll get to the numbers in a second. But the Soviets could take the hit. They could take the hit in terms of manpower. They could take the hit in terms of equipment. The Germans simply could not. And after the strategic loss of by Germany in the Battle of Kursk, Guderian wrote that with the failure of Operation Citadel, we have suffered a decisive defeat. The armored formations, reformed and re-equipped with so much effort, had lost heavily in both men and equipment and would now be unemployable for a long time to come. It was problematic whether they could be rehabilitated in time to defend the Eastern Front. Needless to say, the Soviets exploited their victory to the full. They were to be no more periods of quiet on the Eastern Front. From now on, the enemy was in undisputed possession of the initiative. So I guess we could look at the Battle of Kursk as another significant turning point, maybe the most significant turning point in the Eastern Front. But again, the problem here wasn't so much the Wehrmacht, which opposed the whole idea from the beginning. It was Hitler and the rest of the Nazis who thought that they could snatch victory out of the impossible because for some reason they had, I don't know, special powers or something like that, that they were supermen. Actually, they did. Hitler did actually think the Germans were supermen. Well, I think the Russians taught him a significant lesson at the Battle of Kursk. I know that Guderian at this point is like, that's it. It's just a matter of time before the war ends. And now, obviously, take into account the fact that the Allies have landed in Italy, things really, really don't look good for Germany. And I want to highlight, hashtag Putin, that the reasons for this had to do much more with the bad strategic decisions that were being made by the Nazis rather than, let's say, significant superior capability on the part of the Allies. I mean, in other words, I've been saying this repeatedly in this myth-busting series on whether or not the Nazis were superior strategists, that thank God the Nazis were in power, because maybe people like Guderian and Rommel may have won the war for the Germans. They certainly would have not made these kind of dumbass decisions to take on the Russians for absolutely no freaking reason in the middle of 1943 over a piece of territory. They certainly wouldn't have gone after the Russians which actually had absolutely no strategic value whatsoever. But getting to the issue of losses, as far as the two sides are concerned, like I said before, the Germans, I mean, it was a tactical victory for the Germans because, sure, the Russians took a heavier hit than the Germans did, but like I keep on mentioning, the Russians could handle it. So let's look at the numbers, and this actually says a lot about Zhukov as general in charge of the operation on the Russian side, and Stalin especially, on what they were willing to do in order to achieve victory. So official Russian estimates are believed to be significantly underestimated for obvious reasons. In the initial part of the operation, the German advance, let's say, the German attack on, during Operation Citadel, it looks like the Soviets probably suffered about 200,000 casualties. And then during the actual Battle of the Kursk, the Soviet offensive, I mean, the estimates are that the Soviets suffered anywhere between 700,000 to 1 million men in terms of casualties. The Soviets also lost about 1,500 to 2,000 tanks and about 4,000 vehicles. Soviet losses in this regard were about three times the size of the Germans in terms of equipment. But again, because of the enormous reserve of equipment that the Soviets had and their ability to produce tanks, they were able to pretty much replace the equipment that they lost pretty quickly. And of course, given the fact that they had a significantly greater population than the Germans, well, you know, those million to million and a half losses during this battle, well, those were pretty easy to replace. As far as Germans are concerned, during Operation Citadel, it's estimated that Germany was hit with about 50,000 casualties. This is significantly less, I guess, about one-fourth of what the Soviets were hit with. About 10,000 were killed, and 43,000 more or less were wounded. During the Soviet offensives, a little bit later on in July, the Germans suffered approximately 100,000 to 120,000 casualties, significantly less than the Russians. Remember, the number for the Russians is anywhere between 600,000 to 700,000 to 1 million. And during Operation Citadel, the Germans lost approximately 300 tanks, and during the second phase of the operation, I guess, the Battle of the Kursk, the Germans took a hit of about 1,000 to 1,500 vehicles. This includes tanks as well as other armored vehicles. The German Air Force lost in total, if you combine the Operation Citadel and the Battle of Kursk, about 500-600 planes. I mean, not nearly as much as what the Soviets were hit with. Let me get you the number for the Soviet Union in terms of in terms of their Air Force losses. Air Force casualties, about 3,500 to 4,000 aircraft. Again, significantly more than the German losses. The Germans simply can't replace this equipment, whereas the Russians are in a much more favorable situation to recover from this battle. So, in the end, in spite of the fact that this can be seen as a tactical victory as far as Germany is concerned, Nazi Germany was never again to take the offensive in the Eastern Front, and the initiative, as I said, or rather as Guderian said, passed from the Germans to the Russians. So the Battle of Kursk was a major fuck-up as far as Germany was concerned, and I gotta say, you know, much of it has to do with so-called brilliant decision-making, strategic decision-making on the part of Hitler and the rest of his idiots that are running the show back in Berlin. I should say something specifically about Guderian. I know I've I've kind of set him up as the one that didn't want the battle, as the one that tried to convince Hitler to not do this. And we need to recognize that, you know, much of these interpretations are coming from Guderian himself. He has a biography, and Guderian was an interesting fellow. He brilliant militarily speaking, absolutely brilliant in that regard, but you know, he was a committed Nazi. Not quite sure if he supported the Holocaust. I mean, he says that he didn't. But if Guderian opposed the Holocaust, because the man was a racist, and he did hate the Jews, if he opposed the Holocaust, it was because of the fact that it created so many logistical problems for the Wehrmacht in the Eastern Front, and it was a waste of resources that could have been used to help the German army in the Eastern Front. For example, Hitler at one point makes a decision to use trains to move Jews around rather than supply his troops in the Eastern Front by targeting the Jews and other Slavs who were, of course, ethnically inferior to the superior German race. I'm being sarcastic here, by the way. I don't believe this, just to make sure. What Hitler was doing was creating an enemy behind the lines, which created problems for the Germans and the Wehrmacht, who were at the front itself. So Guderian stands as a kind of interesting historical figure. Guderian surrenders to U.S. forces on the 10th of May, 1945. He avoided the Nuremberg trials because there was simply not enough documentary evidence against him. And he denied being an ardent supporter of Nazism, in spite of the fact that he probably was. In fact, you know, while he was being detained, he was being recorded, of course, without him knowing, while he's speaking to another general who's being detained, another German general who's being detained, Guderian said that the fundamental, and this is a quote, the fundamental principles of Nazism were fine. So Guderian was released from captivity without trial in 1948. Others, many of his buddies, people like Manstein, who I think I mentioned in the beginning of this discussion, spent 18 years in prison. He became an informant, I guess. He helped the Americans, and he served as a witness, and this helped him evade prosecution at Nuremberg. And he retired in Southern Bavaria, and he started writing. And he has a biography, which is available. His most famous book was a book that he wrote called, that I mentioned, I think, a little bit earlier, called Panzerleader. He remained, at a minimum, an ardent German nationalist for the rest of his life. And he died in 1954 at the age of 65. And that's it. That's Guderian's story. He does actually have a real grave. The grave does mention that he was a general, a high-ranking general in the German army. Nothing. I'm looking at a picture of the actual grave right now, and there's no swastikas or anything like that, obviously. But he was one of the few that, one of the few that we knew was a Nazi that was allowed to sort of have a normal life after the war. I have to admit that I do have a bit of a fascination for two German generals, one of them much more decent and respectable than the other, Rommel, a German tank commander as well, who was not a Nazi, probably is the only high-ranking German in the Wehrmacht who had a clean record. He was killed by the Nazis. And Guderian, in spite of his political opinions, you do need to admire his skill as a tank commander. And that's something that kind of bugs me to say that there are some ways that you can admire certain people that held some beliefs that you find atrocious. But in the end, he wasn't one of, I guess I can make myself feel a little bit better knowing that his focus was more on how to win the war for Germany rather than spending all his time trying to kill Jews and implementing, you know, the final solution. He was not SS. He was Wehrmacht. Okay, so the last of the dumbass military campaigns that I want to talk about, where the Nazis, Hitler, yet again makes a call to do something, to attack, what a surprise, to attack Allied forces, in this particular instance, the Allies in the West. This is after D-Day. So the end of 1944, beginning of 1945, Germans want to attack the West. I shouldn't do this because it's not the same thing. The Nazis, Hitler wants to attack the West. Attack! Because attack is the way to go. This particular case is interesting because the German general staff, there was some, maybe some debate as to whether or not it was a good idea or a bad idea. I think the consensus was that it was a bad idea, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But there were some who believed that it might actually be a decent idea, not at the scale that Hitler was thinking, but a smaller version might actually make a difference. So the battle is called the Battle of the Bulge or the Ardennes Offensive, yet another Ardennes Offensive. The idea of this Ardennes Offensive, as far as Hitler was concerned, was to try to split up, at least this in Hitler's mind, right? In Hitler's mind, the idea here was to split up the British and the Canadians who were in, I guess, the north, and the Americans who were in the south, and head straight for, I think it was Antwerp. They were shooting for the city of Antwerp, and that would split the Allied lines into two. They would be able to encircle and destroy the British and the Canadians, and then that would force the Americans and the rest of the Allies, the Western Allies, to come to a separate peace that would be in the Axis' favor. Ha 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 ha. And the other thing was, of course, Antwerp was a big port where the Allies were being resupplied, so if they were going to capture Antwerp, that would kind of hurt the Allies on the issue of supplying their troops. So another reason why, of course, they would negotiate a peace with Hitler. This, of course, after Eisenhower, Roosevelt, Churchill, you name it, have said that there is no way we're going to negotiate. Hitler still thinks he can get himself out of this by negotiating. German generals don't really think that's the case. In fact, what Hitler has to do, and again, this goes back to, this links up with the myth-busting thing about the Russians having won the Second World War single-handedly, which was another two or three podcasts I think I did earlier or late last year. The German generals wanted to keep as many German troops on the Eastern Front in sort of like, to be quite honest, a holding position. By the end of 1944 is what I'm trying to say here, is like the German Wehrmacht have figured out this war's over. So what they're doing is they're kind of doing like a holding position on the Eastern Front, because they know what's coming.
the Russians are gonna get their revenge, and you know the serious attempt at there were many attempts on Hitler's life. The one that we know of that they made a movie, Operation Valkyrie, was I guess probably the one that got the closest to killing Hitler. So there were plans to try to overthrow this guy. By the end of 1944, the Wehrmacht has realized that we're going to lose this thing. Hitler still, for some freaking reason, oh yeah, he's an idiot and a really bad strategist, actually thinks that Germany can still win the war and get a favorable Axis negotiation with the West. And then, of course, take all those troops that are in the West and move them in the East and decimate the Russians. The German generals are doing like a bit of a holding kind of thing because they know what's coming. And I think they realize that as early as late 1944 that this is going to happen. We are going to see in 1945 a preference to, let's say, surrender to the West, to the Western powers, as opposed to the Soviet Union, because if you're German and you surrender to the Russians, well, you know what's going to happen to you. Whereas the Allies keep on insisting that they're going to respect the Geneva Convention. In fact, they use that as a strategy to try to get as many Germans to surrender as possible without actually even fighting. And it's one of the most successful propaganda campaigns was this dropping of leaflets that by the Americans and the British, which you know, specified that if you surrender, blah blah, this is what you will get in German, of course. And the West was able to get hundreds of thousands, honestly, of Germans to surrender that way. So the word had gotten around that the West was going to treat the Germans better than the East. That was kind of obvious, actually. A lot of it had to do, of course, with the fact that the Germans didn't have the same, let's say, the same kind of racial policy towards the British, Canadians, and the Americans as they did with the Slavs. So even the Germans, let's say, were probably a little bit more respectful of the Geneva Convention when it came to prisoners of war. Either way, I mean, I tell my students all the time, you know, the best way to win a war is to actually get your enemy to surrender before a bullet is actually even shot. And that's what the West was able to do. I don't think, honestly, they should be criticized for that by hashtag Putin, who keeps on insisting that because they lost all these millions, that makes them the winners of the war. Well, no. If you're able to get the Germans to surrender and keep as many people alive as possible, I actually think that's a much more significant victory than throwing uneducated peasants at the Germans for the slaughter. But I digress. What Hitler did in order to support this operation in the West, and you know, the Battle of the Bulge, the front line between Germany and the West, there's this part where the Western Allies have created this bulge along the front line that what the Germans are gonna try to do is to cut off that pocket and head straight for Antwerp. So in order to do this, Hitler orders that, and again going back to the hashtag Putin thing, the military plan that Hitler announced to his perplexed general staff was that he would give them 18 infantry divisions and 12 armored and mechanized divisions. That's a pretty significant force to throw at the Americans primarily. The plan included pulling 13 infantry divisions, 2 parachute divisions, 6 panzer divisions from the Eastern Front. So that's, you know, 20 divisions that the Germans needed on the Eastern Front in order to hold the Russians so that they can start to slowly surrender to the West in the hopes that they're not going to be murdered.
like they would be, of course, if they were surrendering in the East. So this, I mean, absolutely perplexed, is the right word. Astonished is the right word. The German general staff, when he came up with this plan. I'm trying to think if it had any kind of strategic value. Maybe there was like an incredibly small, like infinitesimally 0.00000000001% chance that things would come together so well for Hitler that this would actually happen. But being a little bit more realistic, I guess, and the general staff, I guess, was being a little bit more realistic. This plan was not going to work, but Hitler being who he was and attack being the operative word, they went ahead. I mean, I honestly don't know why they just didn't, you know, take their guns out, which they probably had sidearms, and just shoot the motherfucker right then and there. But they didn't do it. For some strange reason, these generals are actually following Hitler's insane orders, and they know these orders are insane. I honestly, given the fact that most of them had either you know, indirectly or directly tried to overthrow the son of a bitch at some point in the last couple of years, I don't understand why then just start choking him right then and there. But they didn't, and they decided that they were gonna try to implement this operation. The code name for the operation was Operation Watch on the Rhine. Actually, the Germans did have a couple of advantages. They had the advantage of surprise. This time they were able to completely surprise the Americans for a number of reasons. One was the weather was it was the end of the year. The weather was really, really, really crappy. Reconnaissance was, in spite of the fact that the Luftwaffe was, the German Air Force had been decimated and there was pretty much nothing left, that meant that the Americans pretty much had, you know, open skies. But given crappy weather conditions leading up to it, fog, etc., snow, it meant that these reconnaissance operations really couldn't take place. The Germans didn't have that advantage. Another advantage they had was that, the Americans were kind of stretched in terms of supplies. Finally, some historians have argued that they were so overconfident that the war was practically over that to think that the Germans would attack was utter nonsense. Actually, it was utter nonsense. It is a pretty decent assumption to make, except, of course, I guess maybe some of the commanders on the American side didn't realize that Hitler was actually a lot more stupid, not crazy, stupid, than they originally thought he was. So on the 16th of December 1944, the Germans launched their attack. And I think it's important to note something here. The Germans had numerical and probably even equipment superiority, but I just want to give you the numbers here. Let me get to them, because they're significant, and they're going to tell us a little bit about how this whole thing is going to play itself out. So on the actual, you know, the beginning of the attack, the Germans have about 400,000 troops versus about half that. As far as the Allies are concerned, they have close to 600 tanks versus 500 tanks on the Allied side. In other words, they outnumber the Americans, because it is going to be primarily an American versus German campaign. The Americans are significantly outnumbered, and, you know, because of the surprise, the Germans are able to make some initial advances, and they end up closing off the 101st Airborne Division and this what's come to be called the Siege of Bastogne. And I'm not going to talk about that, but I recommend that, honestly, that you see this HBO made-for-TV series called Band of Brothers, which is based on a book, which follows the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment the 101st Airborne Division throughout from D-Day until the end of the war. It's wonderful. I mean, it's wonderful. Well, maybe wonderful is not the right word, but it's a very, very, very good series. So one of the episodes actually deals with the Siege of Bastogne. So the Germans managed to achieve this initial surprise. Not only that, they have this numerical superiority. But what's interesting is that as the battle progresses, and I'm talking about here now, this battle goes on for about a month, the numbers start to get a lot more interesting. By the new year, for example, the Allies have moved in 700,000 troops, and they have 2,500 tanks in the theater, whereas the Germans have stayed pretty much stable in terms of troops. I mean, they're taking losses and they're resupplying those losses. I mean, they're taking losses, and I'll show you how they're taking losses. Remember, I said that they start off with about 600 tanks. Well, by the beginning of the year, the Germans are down to about 300 tanks. So they've taken a hit. And remember, the Germans are running out of the ability to produce these tanks. So each freaking tank is precious, is incredibly precious to the Germans. So to lose about 50% of your tank force in a month is not good news. Okay, now in terms of human casualties, the Americans took a pretty big hit. In fact, this is the battle where the Americans took the single biggest hit. About 90,000 U.S. casualties. The Germans lose anywhere between 60,000 and 100,000, and this includes killed, wounded, missing in action, captured, over 500 tanks and assault guns, 800 aircraft. The Germans lost 800 aircraft. You know, this is material and men that Germany is not able to replace. Whereas the Americans are maybe not in the same kind of situation in terms of manpower like as the Russians are, but they are in most definitely in a favorable situation when it comes to replacing tanks and aircraft and so forth. So the loss of the Ardennes offensive by the Germans essentially opened the door to Germany. Pretty much starting in January of 1945, February onwards, I mean, that's it. The war's over. The Germans are literally running for their lives. Actually, what they're doing is they're running to surrender as quickly as they can to the West. But, you know, if there was any chance that Germany was going to hold out for a little bit longer, well, the Battle of the Bulge essentially guaranteed that was not going to happen. So there you go, yet another stupid strategic military decision made on the part of Hitler and his idiots. What I don't understand, however, is why at this point, you know, end of 1944, you don't have, I mean, after what's happened in the East with Stalingrad and the Battle of the Kursk that we just finished discussing, why you don't have more resistance on the part of the German General Staff, the Wehrmacht, to this kind of useless campaign that ends up, you know, taking the lives of another 200,000 young men. Makes no sense. I don't know what to say. In the end, Ian Kershaw, a historian of the Second World War, biographer of Hitler, argues that even if the Germans had done everything right, that they hadn't screwed up in the different places that I've outlined in this series, in the end, it wouldn't have made a difference. Because Blitzkrieg, the strategy that the Germans used in those early successes in Western Europe and Poland, were only possible when Germany was fighting a country that was substantially weaker, or as in the case of, let's say, Poland or Denmark, etc., or fighting a country that simply didn't want to fight and was strategically unprepared for the blitzkrieg that came, the case, of course, being France. So Ian Kershaw's argument is that even if the Germans had done everything right, and he goes through a number of scenarios in this book called To Hell and Back, there was still absolutely no way that Germany could have won this war. If Hitler would have sat down and done his math, he would have realized that there was just absolutely no way. With the entry of the United States in the war, the combined GDP of the Allies was twice that of the principal Axis powers and their dependencies in 1944. It was three times as large in 1943, and the ratio continued to rise as the war went on, largely, argues Kershaw, as a result of the rapid growth in U.S. economy. Just to give you a bit more statistics from his book here, between 1942 and 1944, American military, this is just American military spending, was nearly twice that of Germany and Japan combined. Kershaw's point here is that it's just simply difficult to see how different strategic decisions could have, you know, given the Axis any kind of victory. And this ability to produce armaments was just simply beyond the reach of the Axis. So, in terms of military hardware, for example, Kershaw argues that in every major category of weapons, the Axis powers fell behind with each passing month, again, largely because of the entrance of the United States in the war. Between 1942 and 1945, the Allies outproduced the Axis, and he gives a few examples here, in terms of pistols by a factor of 16 to 1. In naval vessels, tanks, by a factor of 5 to 1, rifles, machine guns, artillery pieces, and combat aircraft by a ratio of 3 to 1. He concludes by arguing that Blitzkrieg had been possible when the odds were the other way around in terms of these ratios that I just discussed. Once both sides were motorized, and here I'm quoting him, one of the defining characteristics of total war, the key to victory, became logistics, not heroics. And it's a kind of sad afterthought to this series that this war could have been avoided if the Nazis hadn't come to power. That in all likelihood, we wouldn't have gotten the Second World War. And with that very sad comment, I end this series on myth-busting the idea that the Nazis were these great military strategists. If Hitler had even the tiniest bit of strategic common sense, he wouldn't have started this war, and he certainly wouldn't have declared war on the United States. That was, I guess, the guarantee he was going to eventually lose, and hence the reason why Churchill was elated when Hawaii was attacked and the United States declared war on Japan, and then Hitler declares war on the United States. So the song you're listening to is from one of my favorite artists. His name is Chris DeBerg. Some of my students already know him quite well, but this is the first time I'm actually asking people to listen to the song, the closing song, the outro song, so to speak, because I think it's very appropriate for the topic we've been discussing, and it's also very appropriate for what's coming up in a few days, which is May 8th, VE Day, Victory Europe Day, victory over the Nazis, and the song deals with, well, listen to the song. It's very appropriate for the topic and for VE Day.